Welcome back to Frontier FM, the essential fundraising podcast for people who want to do good, only better. 5 years ago, the COVID pandemic turned the world upside down. But what happens when the data finally catches up to our instincts? What's actually shifted in our sector and what hasn't? To help unpack it all, I'm joined by two brilliant humans who've crunched the numbers, walked the talk, and lived through the transformation, Wes Moon and Kirk Schmidt. You probably know my co-host today, Wes Moon, VP of Fundraising here at Frontier. But it's worth reminding folks, with over 25 years in the nonprofit sector, Wes has truly seen it all, from boom times to budget cuts, recessions to, yes, a global pandemic. He's one of the sharpest minds I know when it comes to navigating big change with clarity and compassion. And our guest for this episode, he brings not just experience, but real insight. Kirk Schmidt is the Chief Advisor of Operations at the Alberta Cancer Foundation with over 20 years in the nonprofit world. He's been a board member, consultant, and practitioner and has helped raise millions of dollars by pairing sharp KPIs with smart systems and strategy that actually works. He's consulted with over 100 North American charities, and chances are you've heard him speak at AFP Icon or one of the many other conferences where he shares practical, generous wisdom. Kirk also speaks candidly about what it's like navigating the nonprofit world as a neurodivergent professional, and we're lucky to have him with us today. Let's get into it. Here's COVID 5 years on Frontier FM, the essential fundraising podcast.
March 11th. 2020.
Oh, my Lord.
David Silver canceled the NBA season, kicking off basically every cancellation in North America for the whole year.
And then it started. Where were you on March 11th, 2020?
I was in probably the worst place in the world as far as the world was concerned. I was on a cruise ship.
Oh, no.
Now, it was a nerd cruise, and it was full of everybody who not only took 30 seconds to wash their hands, but probably closer to 2 minutes in any given state. Like, just a ship full of germaphobes. We were probably the safest people in the world. And returning to land was probably the most dangerous thing I did. When we returned to land, because we returned to the United States, we had a very real conversation of what happens if we're not allowed to fly? Can we rent a car and bring it up to Canada? If we are unable to rent a car, can we buy an old beater and abandon it effectively? Like these are conversations we had to have because all of a sudden the world shut down.
That's right. The flights. Were you able to make it?
Yeah, we made it back because countries were allowing their citizens to return. So people from the U.S. couldn't go into Canada, I believe already at that point, but we could return because we were Canadian.
That's amazing. Wes?
Well, I was here in Toronto, and on that day, we were meeting a potential acquirer for our business. And our team got together on Slack and said, what should we do? I think we got to be at the meeting because part of it was, you know, meeting the team. That was the meet the team day. So everyone walked to the office. We had our meeting and we all walked home. And a handful of people had a real long walk, actually. It was like they started out early in the morning and got home in the afternoon kind of thing. So it was an interesting day for us. My better half was on a flight from Iceland that day, returning. Luckily, that was the right day.
That's wild.
What about you, Naomi?
I was on a March break ski holiday with my family and friends of ours. And we're like, it's okay. They've just told us all that we're all good. You can still ski. We're outside. We're in a bubble. We're safe. And then I think a day later, or a couple days later, Whistler shut down. And we're like, oh, I guess we're packing it up and going home early. So we packed up and went home early. And you're still on holidays. Seems like so long ago, but at the same time, and sometimes it feels like it was just yesterday. The 5 years.
I have to say, it's gone by incredibly quick. When we were talking about building up this podcast, I was surprised to learn that the pandemic started 5 years ago.
Right?
Shocked.
I think looking at all of the KPIs and the trends is what keeps on reminding me as to how long ago it was, because you see these huge spikes in 2020. And then everything sort of coming back to some sort of normal after that. But that's sort of me is like, oh yeah, that was 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's like going to start dropping off of charts, right? Anybody who does like a 5 year look back, suddenly, you know, a year from now, the COVID year will be completely out of that data set.
Yeah, and it'll change your perspective, right? You know, I think of 5 years ago, and our company was set up with a lot of technology. So we all, you know, we were actively working with clients remotely. We were interacting with our prospects remotely, and our team could work remote if we needed to. Now, we did have that office, but that was so we could be together. But imagine if you're working for a charity that was not set up for that. Naomi, were you sort of in a situation where you like, well, I don't go to work. What do I do?
Yeah, I was working for a nonprofit who provided, you know, frontline care for different types of vulnerable populations. So they weren't able to shut down. But those of us in the office, we all got sent home with our laptops, and that's where we stayed. And it was the ED at the time. She wasn't too sure what to make of it all, because she's very much a, you know, a person. And we're all, you know, we're not going into an office. That's not going to be a reality. And how can we best support our frontline staff, really? And it was very strange.
I remember we, early in the pandemic, our donations processing staff needed to be on site because of just the volume that they handled, having to do all of the scanning and that. So we instituted two shifts. One was an early morning shift. One was an afternoon to kind of early evening shift, so that if one of them went down sick, we still could operate as an organization. And like, I even think about, you know, there are some roles at charities that do not have to necessarily be 9 to 5, 8 to 4, whatever. And, you know, we instituted that and then we rescinded it kind of once the panic was over. But, you know, those types of things that we had to change around very quickly and figure out how we were going to keep people safe and still keep the business running.
So it's a really challenging situation to have so much change in a short period of time. Imagine if you're a consumer, and like, we're all consumers in a way. How did this change your buying habits? Like, my family, we stopped going to the grocery store. We basically made every purchase online that we possibly could. Is it the same for both of you?
Yeah. When I got COVID for the first time, I hadn't been out of the house in weeks. And I went out to get my vaccine. And somebody in the vaccine line must have had it. In terms of our habits, you know, because all the grocery stores started to do online shopping very quickly, and grocery delivery and or curbside or like whatever way you could do it where you didn't ever enter a space with other people. Yeah. And still do some of that. Like, I still get groceries delivered every so often. Not as much, but, you know, there's sometimes where it's the convenience of it and we got used to it.
And it took a while to get accustomed to, you know, how do you order bananas? It was the biggest joke, right? You'd get either one singular banana or you would get 5 bundles of banana, right? It was bananas. It was never exactly what you wanted. But I think by the end, we all kind of figured it out. And now it's wasted knowledge. Hopefully it remains wasted knowledge of how to do that. But I know with my children got quite accustomed to having delivery every day. you know, something fun is at the door. And now they're still going through a bit of withdrawal and really want to have that. They don't want to go to a store and get immediate gratification. They prefer to order something online and then have it show up a few days later. It's kind of, it's shifted their habits a little bit because that's sort of what they got used to at that younger, more impressionable age, I guess.
I think that leads into like some of these changing habits, which when we talk about these general habits of the world, we're also talking about the general habits of donors and volunteers. But, you know, my family, we were never home before the pandemic. And even now, still 5 years later, we're almost always home. And the feeling of connectedness that we have to our communities has diminished. We've seen data that suggests that is sort of a nationwide phenomenon. And we also know that feeling of connectedness makes someone more likely to be a donor, being parts of community. So we really did see a massive shift in consumer and donor behavior overnight. And some of that still persists today.
I would argue that things like galas are only now starting to see the numbers that they once had. And it still feels like, I mean, there's some very seasoned people doing a lot of this work, but it still feels like sometimes there was knowledge lost in all of this, or like people forgot how things get run. And that's not for every organization, but certainly like it feels like some of that, the best practices that we had learned and had going up to 2020 were almost relearning, even though they haven't really changed, but just because how people interacted, to your point, I think that has morphed so many times over the last few years that we're only now returning to this phase where people are like, oh yeah, it's okay to go out and be near people and, you know, shake hands with people and all of these things. So I think we're just starting to see a reemergence, you know, at least on that front.
If you think of the digitization that has taken place, 6 years ago, the only thing that was digital at an event was maybe the check-in and some emails that went back and forth telling people how to get there. I think the expectation now, you know, I was at a Blue Jays game yesterday and I had digital tickets in my virtual wallet, for instance. There, I can't possibly get a ticket. I have to buy that ticket online. I then transfer that ticket, one ticket off to a friend, and it's in their virtual wallet, and I've got one in my virtual wallet. Is that happening, Kirk? Are you seeing that with the events that you're associated with?
Yeah. I mean, just speaking about sports, though, and the impact of this, which I think is, even though it's not necessarily, you know, the charitable sector, it's interesting to note. I was talking with somebody with the Calgary Stampeders organization, and what used to happen in Calgary is you'd have people who would be sales of large companies would have stacks of tickets for games that they would hand out to their clients or potential clients. And when it went to that digitization, they lost a whole lot of season ticket holders because nobody wanted to do this weird digital transfer things. And I know I saw something a few weeks ago from the Stampeders organization saying, like, if you want paper tickets, we can do paper tickets. So they have had to return to that because of the damage that it did. And it wouldn't surprise me if, I don't know that there's been any research on it, but wouldn't surprise me if that has happened in the charitable sector, that people don't want to have to deal with downloading an app in order to check in and all of those things. Like, it's not yet hit an ease where you can just use the things that you already have or that type of thing. So there has been a digitization. I don't know if it's been to the detriment of anything.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that. Recently, looking at the released CRA data, the Canadian Revenue Agency on charitable giving, half of the funds donated in 2023, technically claimed on a tax as a tax credit, came from seniors 65 years and older, 50%.
Right.
So, you know, if we're talking about half those funds coming from seniors, are we then asking our seniors to jump through digital hoops unnecessarily?
Possibly. So one of the things that happened early in the pandemic was we had a direct mail piece about ready to go out. Like, it had been printed, it was ready to send. And we had to have an internal conversation about, do we send this out given the nature of the crisis? And luckily, we were able to convince the organization that is the right move. But a lot of organizations pulled back on that. So not only did we like have this mass digitization where, you know, we were looking at people to adopt that, but a number of organizations pulled back on direct mail or anything else that would serve kind of that elder population who might not be as digitally savvy on average. And I know there was research done 2022-ish that showed that the organizations that invested during the pandemic ended up ahead, and the organizations that pulled back were up to 5 years behind. And so, you know, it's one of those things where we got a lot of good out of digitization, and I think learned a lot about digitization, but there was also a pullback on the analog way of doing things at the same time, as if they can't both be done at the same time. And I think that ended up doing more harm than the good that digitization was able to provide.
And I think we're still unlearning. People are still unlearning a lot of that. It's still all in, throwing out, everyone's moving to digital now. We're seeing it every year increases in the number of people who are, you know, donating online and thinking, I'm just going to stop doing the offline, the direct mail packages, anything that's not, you know, digital. And it's that all or nothing mentality is still very much there. And to your point, I think it's something that folks could really learn from, is that it's not an all or nothing game. And there is sort of the happy medium. And I love the idea that, you know, with the Stampeders going back to paper tickets, you know, everything old is new again type of thing. And it's sometimes it's not broken, the old system. And we can benefit from that.
One of the other big challenges, I think, to consumers at large was sort of like the tightening of the supply chain, which is interesting because we're kind of seeing that right now as well with sort of the geopolitical landscape that we find ourselves in. Did that affect charities?
I don't think it affected charities as much as the more recent crises, and like from the tariff situation in the United States, as well as, you know, the Canada Post strikes and the effects of those. I would argue that those were crises that probably affected charities much more disproportionately. But like when I worked for the last organization I was with, we actually ended up in an advantageous situation because of COVID when it came to our branded merchandise. Because all of a sudden there was a pullback in the requests for goods from China for whatever reason. And that actually gave us a lot of negotiating power and allowed us to, there was a product that we typically bought that we were able to get for probably a 20 to 25% discount than we normally would on our wholesale price, which meant, you know, more money as we sold it. And so that helped us, you know. Was that enough to really fund anything major? No, but it was a consequence of the COVID pandemic.
Yeah. And I suppose on the program side, anyone in healthcare certainly felt that supply chain. But from fundraising, I never really witnessed it, but, you know, we have a smart crew here. I wasn't sure if anyone else had seen that.
But I still think the biggest impact of fundraising was the decisions made in terms of budgeting and the furloughing of employees and all of those things, rather than, you know, being able to get paper envelopes, anything like that, that we would normally use from a supply chain perspective in fundraising. Yeah. Obviously, there was the impact to events, but I don't know that there were supply chain issues necessarily with some of that stuff anyways. But, you know, when it comes to program delivery, if any charity used vehicles, for example, like there was massive supply chain issues with vehicles that we're still feeling now. Like, only now are we starting to see lots, you know, get as many vehicles as they once had. So you can imagine if you're a, you know, if you're delivering food, if you're providing rides to people for whatever reason, you know, you're using older equipment, that the cost of that has gone up. Probably, you know, that you're holding on to vehicles longer than you normally would because it's just not worth it to change. Like it likely changed a lot of that program delivery side.
But I'm glad we talked about it. I don't know. I was curious if you guys had an idea. I think you're right. Like, I don't know if we want to even do this, but like 08, people who held back, like it took forever for them to recover. Maybe never, right?
So I have a question around that. So in COVID, I know some folks, organizations were just so reticent to ask for money because they're like, there's these, you know, horrible things happening. People aren't working. We can't go out and ask for money. Even people who were helping people on the front lines were holding back and asking for money because they felt bad. 2008, did you see a similar type of experience where organizations were also were in the middle of a recession, people are losing their homes, we're not going to go out and ask for money, we're going to pull back on appeals? Did you see that?
I was in a position where I was working with a number of leading charities across Canada. Many of them pulled back specifically around acquisition. You know, their acquisition budget went down to 10% of what it was in like 07, 06, 05 kind of thing. And what I can say is that, you know, over the years of working with these organizations, they never got their acquisition machine back to where it was.
And I think that's an interesting thing to note about even COVID and thinking about, you know, what have we learned or what have we failed to learn? COVID was a lot of the same decision-making that happened in 2008. It's very likely that charities are going through the same decision-making process when it comes to the United States, given the pullback of granting and all of the decisions being made by government entities. You know, you have to wonder, are we just going to constantly see charities fail to recognize that this is a pattern? And every time there's a crisis, for whatever reason, the inclination will be to pull back. The inclination will be, we don't want to offend anybody. And again, we will watch organizations fall behind and effectively never recover to a level that they were once at or on the precipice of becoming.
I'd make a controversial statement here. Organizations don't make decisions, people do.
Sure.
And, you know, sometimes decisions are made out of fear instead of confidence. And I think maybe better said, playing it safe is better than, you know, being aggressive in a soft market. And I think that's what you see if you're making a very important decision like this and you're involving your board and you're a leader. Do you want to make sure that you can do what you say you can do? If that's true, then, you know, like pulling back is a better decision.
Sure.
Is it the right decision? It's an entirely different point.
And I've talked about this before, but every decision that you make as a charity is, do you want money now or do you want money later? And all decision-making in charities really, or at least the fundraising side, comes down to that. It is, do you take money that you could invest in whatever to put towards programs so that you can deliver those now? Or do you put it towards that investment so that you can have a larger amount of money later? And, you know, to that point, and I've heard accountants talk about this, cutting is something they can control. You know, revenue is kind of this magic projection that could be affected by all sorts of things, including global markets and customer sentiment and all of that, whereas cutting is controllable. And I guess the question then becomes, if you're a donor to an organization, would you rather the organization suffer long term so that this year they can deliver their programs? But of course, that can have real human consequences, right? I tend to work for health charities where you're fundraising for research and that type of thing. But if you're providing for people who are unhoused or need immediate intervention, that's a very different situation because you're now, that money now versus money later also has implications on people's livelihood.
So what I'm hearing a little bit here is, maybe I'm wrong, but in some ways, it is in these times to sort of double down a little bit instead of pulling back. When you're going to be faced with making these decisions, maybe make the opposite of what you would conceivably think is the right thing to do, which is pull back instead and double down and ask for more, or try and, you know, acquire more donors. And maybe it's our responsibility to help provide fundraisers with some of the data to show to their boards to say, hey, look, this is what happens if we're going to pull back, or if we stay the course, or if we push a little further.
Really, to extend what you're saying, is I would actually argue it's not necessarily about the decision of doubling down or not. It's when you make that decision. I don't think a crisis is when you should be making that decision. Like the old adage of never go to the grocery store when you're hungry, right? Like, maybe the time to talk about what you will do in a major disaster, a major economic collapse, a major health event, a rogue government destroying the entire granting infrastructure. What is your game plan? And you can't come up with every scenario, but at least if you know that philosophically, you know what, we know that when we're down, we're going to keep our staff. If they can't do the job that they were hired for, we will redeploy them elsewhere. You know, like Best Buy did that when they went through significant cuts. They ended up holding on to all their staff and they just said, we're going to move people around rather than cut staff. Make those decisions now and have that at least as a guiding policy that the board has approved so that you can move quickly. Because the problem in any of these crises is you have to move quickly. You're not thinking straight because, as you said, Wes, like people are acting out of fear. Fear is not strategy. You know, you have the opportunity now, like maybe in between these crises is the appropriate time to make those decisions.
Yeah, I love this concept. You know, realistically, you have your plan. You know, Mike Tyson famously said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face, which is like what the pandemic really was. I mean, we all got walloped, really. And having an emergency plan to fall back to, even if it comes down to the infrastructure for making decisions. I personally enjoy making decisions when I have all the info. Unfortunately, that doesn't usually happen. Information is obfuscated, it doesn't exist. And maybe you want to wait a little bit longer for more detail and more clarity. If you have a framework for making decisions, you have a path forward. You don't need your leader to say, we're making this decision and we're making it in 3 days and everyone get your input right now. Because that's a very hard ask to make of everybody if they're not prepared for it.
There's real human element to these decisions that are made too, and not just from the people who are helped by the charitable infrastructure, but staff. And, you know, one thing that I have hammered on over and over again is how COVID failed the staff of charities. I've talked a little bit about how when people were forced to go home, there weren't a lot of charities that provided desks and chairs that were ergonomically safe. They didn't really provide for faster internet to handle all of the additional bandwidth that people might need. You know, so there were a number of costs that were borne by staff. And then when people moved back to the office and they had to now pay for parking again and things like that, there were additional costs that were borne by the staff that most charities didn't provide. There were plenty of times organizations during COVID who chose not to give any type of cost of living increase, things like that. And I wonder how much of these reports that we're seeing of all of the people who are leaving the sector now, all of the people who have burned out in the sector, like how much of that was borne by not being staff first in mentality, and how much of even, you know, when we saw loss of fundraising dollars, how much of that was because if you're not providing for the people who are raising the money, you know, it becomes harder to raise the money in general. You know, and I wonder if we've learned anything from that side of it.
There's probably even more to it than that. You know, like the older and more established your organization is, the harder it is to change a policy, let's say. And, you know, a work from home policy can be written. Will you get it right on your first shot? If you're doing it in 2 or 3 days, absolutely not. If you've never done it before, you have no chance of getting that right. So, you know, you kind of make your first shot of a policy, but as again, like these older organizations really struggle to change or even write policy. Changing is actually even harder than writing it. Even if you just wrote it yesterday, sometimes it's like, well, I can't just change that one thing. But even if these fundraisers who are at home now have their laptops, do they have a place to work in their home that's quiet? Do they even know what to do? So, you know, like kind of looking back again, 5 years ago, we were sort of taken back in time all the way to the Wild West, where like there weren't really any rules. There weren't really best practices on how to do this from home. And everyone, every individual contributor, every manager was just trying to figure it out from scratch.
And I think there were good things that came from that Wild West nature. Like when you think about if you had to take a Zoom call or Teams or whatever, you know, 6, 7 years ago, would you ever be caught dead wearing pajama pants? Even just in case, would you be aghast if your kids accidentally walked into the room or a pet walked in and started barking, that type of thing? And there's almost this normalization of like everybody has a home life. There'll be people wearing like a collared shirt and shorts, and they might get up and you're like, oh, that's funny, I'm doing the same thing. Like the number of calls I've been on where like everybody's wearing a collared shirt and shorts, and there's this recognition of like, yep, that's what working from home is, you know. And there were some good things that came from that, from I would argue from a culture standpoint. But yeah, that like everything was new. And everything we thought we knew about professionalism and working from home and all of those things kind of just went out the window.
Yeah. And I think the sector just became a little more scrappy because of it, which is important.
Sure.
Unfortunately, on the flip side is what you're seeing, I think, 5 years on, is a lot of organizations not being so scrappy anymore, going, no, we need to go back. We need people in the office 3 days a week, and we need to, you know, be not wearing our shorts with our collared shirts and that sort of thing. And it is all about that sort of that professionalism and that facade. And a lot of people moved to have a better quality of life, not relishing in the fact that you didn't have to commute. And now you're hearing about, you know, 3 days a week. Well, you can't live, you know, 2 hours away if you're having to go in 3 days a week. And how much more productive are you? I mean, I love people and I love being with people. I also appreciate that I am way more productive working at home because I have no one to talk to, right? And I'm more focused on what I'm doing. And, you know, there's some sort of perfect medium here, but I think having that work-life balance certainly has to outplay than being in the office from 8 until 5 until your boss leaves, because that's what's important to them. And I see that coming back a lot into the culture and this distrust of employees and that sort of ideology, which I think is too bad. I think we really could have benefited from continuing on with that flow. And for nonprofits, the amount of money that can be saved in not having that overhead is quite amazing, right? And also you can attract talent from all across the country.
We never quite learned through this whole process, and I think is part of the reason why there has been a push towards back in the office, and that is there is something natural about when people are together and people just happen to be walking the hallways and like somebody mentions a problem that you overhear and you go, oh, I know about that, I can help you with that. We never quite got, how do you recreate that natural way of dealing with things in a remote environment? And I think had we solved that in some way, and maybe there is no solution, maybe that's why we haven't, but had we solved for that, I don't know that the push toward being back in the office would have been as strong. Obviously, there are many factors, like people are paying leases and, you know, you don't want to create a smaller space only to have to go back to a larger space later. There's a lot of reasons why somebody might want people in the office, but it feels like that was the piece that people were trying to recreate by having everybody go back in. And it's really difficult because it's not measurable by really any means. It's kind of this colloquial idea that when people are together, magic happens. And I think we've all seen it. It's not like it's a lie or something that's fake, but it's also this nebulous idea that has become part of the reason why, you know, we need at least some level of hybrid.
And that is a really great point for having everyone in the office on the same days as well. So I've seen some where it's like, oh, well, these people are going to come in on this day. These people are going to come in on that day. So it's still staggered and you're not able to benefit from that. So I think they're sort of missing the point. To that end, I also think, you know, I think we're all a little further on in our careers. I mean, you're always learning, but I also feel bad for anyone who's starting out their career. How do they get more immersed and exposed to everything else that's going on with that organization? Because you are literally remote and removed from the conversations. You're not hearing things that you can pick up nuance from. So I feel like that generation or that people are at that point in their career in some ways are the ones that are losing out the most on that. And that is also something else. How do you fix that? How do you, replicate that from a remote standpoint?
Any success that I have, I owe to the people who I was working with when I first started in fundraising and being exposed to their ideas, their way of thinking, their language, their professionalism. So I think that is the most important piece that's missing within office. But I also think, at least I do personally, romanticize being in an office. I'm pretty productive at home. And I think I'm actually quite good at working in an office and not just doing my work, but making strong connections and absorbing more information than I do sitting at my desk here in my basement. But the reality is probably it's not worth as much as I think it is just because I like it. That's why I want to go back to an office. I like it. And I like the connections that I make with people and I like the mentorship, that I've been able to do later in my career for those newer in their career. Does this bleed over into actual, the over-digitization of fundraising that's taken place the last 5 years?
Quite possibly. It's an interesting question. I remember pre-pandemic even having discussions with people about how the number of gifts that we were seeing online was, pre-pandemic, it was 12 to 15%. And it was going up by maybe 1% a year. But if you looked at the amount of budget being allocated to digital, and because charities are charities and God forbid you actually increase your expense budget, what it actually meant is that money was being taken from the analog channels and moved to digitization for this percent on percent increase. So that discussion was already happening pre-COVID. But it is really interesting to wonder, has the way that we fundraise had an effect on office culture as well? And yeah, I like that question. And I don't know if there's a good answer for it.
I don't have an answer. Otherwise, I would have talked on, as they say.
But it speaks to that lack of community as well, right? Well, you started off before talking about that. And it's that lack of cohesion that we are all lacking. And if we're trying to find ways of building that community with our donors, how are we able to replicate that and find a way of creating that community with our coworkers?
There has been a move away from events, both of the bespoke manner, the peer-to-peer, even small events. It's less of what we do in fundraising now.
What's interesting, so I work for an organization that has a major annual event, and it's coming up in a few weeks, and we're slated to do one of our best years, if not possibly the best year we've ever had. I don't want to take credit away from the team, because I think the team has gotten more sophisticated. The team has really put the work in to make that happen. I wonder if it perfect stormed, though, the same way that our direct mail did really well during the pandemic because everybody else was pulling away from it. And is this going to be the case where almost like, you know, as the flock moves one way, the few that stand out end up doing better in that space? They then present at conferences about, you know, hey, events are back and like, look at how well we're doing. Everybody flocks back that way. And then it all, like all that income gets distributed. Is there a level of just pendulum swing there that, you know, people are moving away from events because of the consequences of COVID? Those that stuck with them are now doing better. And then eventually it's going to go the other way.
I love to talk about organizational inertia as it pertains to charities. It's a real thing.
Sure.
And, you know, if you think of objects in motion tend to stay in motion, the people who manage to keep their events going, I think, are the ones who are continuing to do their events now, but there's a lot less noise out there.
Yeah.
So is it that? Are we seeing, I've heard recently of a couple events that all have had their very best years ever with some big numbers attached to it. So is it part of that community? Is it a less cluttered space? Maybe both. But I don't think we can forget about the impact on the community. If you think of any of those large experiential type events that were popular, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that's what it was. People were there to take part in this wonderful community that didn't just bring people together like they were fighting against something and they experienced something at the same time. Maybe the window's open for those kinds of events again to be really successful.
I think people want to, like people are lonely and people want to reach out. And, you know, I've heard it talked about how a lot of kids right now don't actually have the same social skills that their older peers do because they just had several years where they weren't exposed to it, like especially in early development years. But even as adults, like, people are lonely and people don't know how to interact anymore. It feels weird going out for drinks sometimes with large groups of people. And so, yeah, there's a level of maybe this, like, I know there's a lot of fundraising professionals who will say, don't do galas, don't do events. I love events for a number of reasons. I don't think events are your money makers necessarily, but they, to your point, they drive the community. They create the community. They're an acquisition source in a lot of ways. And maybe it is what we need as a society right now.
To build on that, I think you're talking about how it's that community. It's also, and you're saying how it's difficult to sometimes go out for drinks. It's awkward. So this is a contrived experience that there's structure and there's rules around it. There's a plan. There's opportunities to not have to talk to the person awkwardly who's sitting to your left or right that you don't know because there's going to be a big presentation. There's speeches. There's a shared moment that you can then have something to talk to that person about and you're making real life connection. And oftentimes they're also really showing you the impact that your donations are making. So you're also fulfilling that bucket of I'm doing good. I'm not going out because I just want to go out on a Friday or Saturday night and get all dressed up. I'm going out for a reason. There's a cause. There's meaning to these actions that I'm doing. These are meaningful connections. It's all bringing it to this whole new level that we were missing out on. And anyhow, and I think that structured process of a gala speaks to that.
Do you think to my autistic brain, what a social event with rules? Yes.
Just like thinking on this point, these kinds of events shut down pretty hard, pretty much across the board. And some charities were really burned because this represented a lot of their annual revenue. Is that why fundraisers are out there saying, you know, don't do events, they may get taken away again?
Maybe. I think there's a lot of things to unpack there. Like, that I would say that when we saw the initial wave of furloughs in COVID, it was the event staff of almost every charity. That's who were kicked out first. And, you know, the people who were left were the annual giving people, the legacy donations people, the major gift people. And I've worked with enough charities to know that there's a lot of times where major gift fundraisers see no reason to have events at all. Annual giving people often are very anti-event. Not always. Like, I don't want to generalize, but I would say if I hear somebody being against events, those tend to be where they come from. And there's been nobody to argue back to go, okay, but events do this, and events do this, and events do this, because they were all fired. And they were never rehired at the same level. So they've left the industry unless they re-educated, retooled into some other form of fundraising, or in some charities' cases, maybe they kept them and put them somewhere else. But like, there's also nobody to defend it.
Yeah, so a lack of ownership, a lack of talent is probably also leading into sort of an emptiness in the event space. Yeah, because it doesn't, you know, you turn the lights off, they're off long enough, they just don't go back on.
And the knowledge of how to build off of. If you have to start fresh, it's a steep learning curve if you don't have the right mentors in place and the organizational learnings and that sort of thing. I'm curious about we're talking about events and how great they are in terms of the, building that community. There's I'm seeing a bit of a trend in for-profit and nonprofit for these experiential displays or mini events. Like Severance just did that, where they had the staff, it was in the New York subway, and they were just pretending like they were working for Lumen, right? So they were set up there and they had the office. And so everyone could walk by and see them. And you see, you know, nonprofits, IKEA has done some partnerships in the UK with this is, you know, what a shelter looks like. And there's these, it's not an event per se, but it's something that you can go in and you can experience. It's tactile. You can have this real world kind of experience and to bring it to something that's slightly more scalable than a huge gala. And is that something that we perhaps didn't have at this pre-COVID that is trying to fill that void as well?
I've seen the experiential marketing in a few different places pre-COVID. I think what we're seeing now is a far more interesting version of it, where you do have the physical activity, but the reach is so much greater, you know, using social and digital channels. So there's only a few examples before of charities where that was successful, like flash mobs or something like that. But now, you know, if you're paying attention to your phone long enough in a day, you'll see something. I think like that's one of the benefits that the sector has really leaned into, which is being able to expand the reach digitally. And most charities can at least do today a little bit of that work themselves.
You know, as a general statement, especially like think about some of the discussion we've had, I feel like COVID was the opportunity to kind of do a little bit of yes and with the sector, right? Like there's so many good things we had in the sector, maybe some things that needed to change a bit, but I don't think that there was anything that was absolutely disastrous that needed to be abandoned and was successfully abandoned due to COVID. But there are some things where like events where we were, because people had to be creative and come up with new approaches to things, and that there's a level of like, now we can have events and events plus, you know, now we can do these different things. You know, you can go to the grocery store, but you can also have it delivered in those cases where you need it. You know, there's a lot of things that came out of COVID that are that way. And I think my fear would be that we're going to lose that if there's a shift to simply go, okay, let's, you know, we're good to go back to the way we were, that's going to forget the lessons that we learned too. And I think the biggest thing out of COVID was that we had to change. And now we have a whole lot of different ideas of how to go forward with things. Just like, let's not lose that. Let's also not lose the things that were good before the pandemic, because that's also the risk.
Kirk, what do you think happens over the next 5 years? Like, what's your great hope?
That is a tough question. I think my hope is that we don't acquiesce to the comfort of people who have been in the sector for a long time and long for days of yore at the expense of the new ways that we've developed at being, at working, at what the definition of professionalism is, at the new ways and the new things we might be able to do with fundraising. And I think my other hope would be that we continue to innovate, that we don't use this, like, we don't take this time to go, okay, let's just return to the way things were, or now we have this new way and we're just going to go with that going forward. We choose actively to not be stagnant, and we choose actively to diversify, because I also think that's how we stave off part of the next crisis. Is the crisis hit places pretty hard when they had a single way of doing things and had no real inclination for internal innovation and quick ability to change. And so I think as a sector in general, we have to kind of accept that the way that we fundraised however many years ago, the way that we certify on how to fundraise might need to change. And we might be a lot more nimble.
Naomi, I know you love a magic wand. If you had one of these magic wands and you got to wave it and change anything in the sector, just based on, you know, our conversation today, so, you know, almost everything, what would you change?
I'm allowed to steal from what Kirk said, because I think the being nimble is really important, I've not worked with every nonprofit out there. Those that I've worked for and work with, I often find that fear of change. And it's that we've always done it this way, and this has produced X, and we're afraid to change it. We've been through COVID, and my goodness, we never want to do anything like that again, right? So that's what I would like to see, just more ability to try things. You try and fail, but at least you've learned that's not the way to do it. I mean, do that on a small basis. And then you find the way to be successful and to diversify, but not be afraid. That's my magic wand. Not be afraid. The old improv. Yes, and.
I mean, it's a good way to go.
It's much better than but.
So now it's my turn for like a real slow pitch. Have you got one for me? Right in the batter's box.
When the next disaster hits, how are we going to be better?
Yeah, so a real simple one. Change up, coming in nice and slow. Thanks, Kirk. You know, so when the next disaster happens or emergency type thing where everything goes up in the air, and gosh, maybe that's going to happen sooner than you think. There are massive technology advancements taking place, specifically in kind of like the world of AI. We've got a world full of geopolitical change. So there's a deck has been thrown into the air, if you will. So like, where do the cards fall? I want to go back to my key takeaway, which I had never considered before this conversation, which is creating a decision-making framework for when we have to make fast decisions. In periods of rapid change, heck, there could be an AI agent, three AI agents next month sitting here doing the same podcast that we're doing now. How would that change our jobs? And I think what we have to be really, really smart about is talking about like the innovation and adaptability that both of you just discussed. But then how do you execute on that? How do you not get stuck? And for me, that was a light bulb moment, Kirk. So thank you for really voicing that in a clear way. And so I'm taking your answer.
Just stroke my ego a little bit more.
He's coming back to the podcast, folks. Mission accomplished.
It's a crisis communications approach or risk management approach. Background. So it's all about that crisis communications and being ready with a whole bunch of different situations on how you're going to act. And you do have to act fast. And we've fortunately or unfortunately lived through so much that we're actually really well prepared now to be able to envision what these different circumstances and situations or crises could be. Yay. Is there one thing, I think you may have said, brought it up already, but I'm just curious, is there one thing that you really hope never comes back from pre-COVID, like that we sort of lost and stays lost?
I can't imagine that we ever go back to a world where we're like scared to email people or push a message. And if we go back to that, you know, the lessons of the pandemic are gone, be it in any channel, not just email, but email was one that seemed, you know, wholly sacred, just to marketers only, not to fundraising. And that to me broke down immediately during COVID. The pandemic hit. Oh, well, we better email our donors and talk to them as if they're a donor. What was almost a novel concept. So in my mind, like if we go back on that one, all is lost.
I think for me, one of the big ones is realizing that talent doesn't have to exist in your geographical area. The number of people I saw hired for roles in complete other cities because the talent was there was something absolutely magical that came out of COVID. And as somebody coming from Western Canada, I can tell you most national charities had no interest in me at all prior to COVID. Especially those headquartered, I'm going to pick on Toronto, headquartered in Toronto. And there's a bit of an insular notion of, like, even Calgary fundraisers. I'm not sure that Calgary fundraisers would consider that any fundraiser from Lethbridge has any particular talent, right? Like that, those cultures existed. And I think that completely broke down as well during COVID, because it was like, what's the difference of somebody working from home in a different time zone, you know? And I would love to see that continue, and that willingness to go for the right person regardless of geographical territory.
Yeah, love it. And on the very same note, what I would love to see coming, and this has nothing to do with fundraising, but it's some sort of normalization on time zones. Scheduling things, like we travel around a lot and I'm always dealing with people in 2, 3, 4 time zones. And gosh, that is harder to deal with than you'd think.
We have 3 different time zones right here.
I think we could do an entire podcast on the abolition of time zones and the move to UTC.
Heck, we could move. If we're doing that, we should just move to like a metric day, a 10-hour day kind of thing. And the world would just be a better place.
And then we can also get rid of the calendar the way it is right now. And we can also get rid of daylight savings, because all of those are ridiculous. Sorry.
Hey, uh-huh. I think this is the choir technically here.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Kirk. If people want to continue the conversation, where can they find you?
The best place is LinkedIn. Luckily, there aren't too many Kirk Schmidts out there. And as far as I know, I'm the only one who's actively involved in charities. So just type in my name. You will find me.
And Wes, what about you?
Easily found on LinkedIn. I'm one of the few Wes Moons out there. And like Kirk, the only Wes Moon in fundraising.
And I can also be found on LinkedIn. If this sparked anything for you, an idea, a challenge, or something that you have questions about, reach out to me or Wes, and we're always up for a real conversation. Reach out via LinkedIn or visit us on our website at associate.com and look for Frontier Under Solutions. Until next time, keep questioning, keep iterating, and for the love of donors, stop ghosting them after year end.